ponder. It's kind of like ponder with an S. It comes from the French word that means to plumb the depths of. It's looking at someone and wondering what their story is, because everybody has a story. All of us are like stars in our own movies, and the people important to us are like our co-stars. But then this guy writes, in the background, faint and out of focus are the extras, the random passerby, each living a life as vivid and complex as your own. They carry on invisibly around you, bearing the accumulated weight of their own ambitions, friends, routines, mistakes, worries, triumphs, and inherited craziness. When your life moves on to the next scene, theirs flickers in place, wrapped in a cloud of backstory and inside jokes and characters strung together with countless other stories you'll never be able to see, that you'll never know exists. So just as they are the invisible extras in our story, we are the extras in theirs. So in the story we read today from Acts 11, the star is Peter. He's on trial because of the thing that happened the chapter before. God gave him this crazy vision of an exotic buffet of foods that Jewish people were never allowed to eat because they believed them to be spiritually contaminated. And yet, here was God putting out a spread of these disallowed foods and telling Peter to dig in. And then this bit of instruction in verse 9, do not call anything impure that God has made clean. And Peter understood what God meant right away. God was talking about people with non-Jewish blood, people they had been taught to shun because these two were spiritually contaminating. It's part of the beliefs that the world where people lived had a kind of spiritual dust, which was not itself the problem, but becomes a problem if they track the dust into sacred places where they enter to interact with God, sacred places like the temple. So that's why there were all these washing rituals to clean themselves off before coming to the temple, and why they were taught to be very careful about avoiding especially dusty places like the homes of non-Jewish people who did not practice their washing rituals and they ate non-kosher foods. But apparently this problem with spiritual contamination in the world was one of the things that Jesus got rid of for us on that first Good Friday and Easter. This spiritual dust in the world no longer had any power to keep us out of sacred places. So they didn't need to worry about being contaminated anymore. Things that used to be contaminated, God had made everything clean. That's what Peter was told in the vision. And right at that moment, after having this vision, there was a knock on Peter's door from a few non-Jewish strangers asking him to come with them into the house, to the house of someone called Cornelius, a retired Roman soldier. Cornelius had for a long time been wanting to worship the Jewish God, but his position in Roman society made it difficult for him to fully convert to the Jewish religion, which had all these practices and rules that would essentially cut him off from all his non-Jewish relationships. So he did what he could to honor God in his own way, by giving generously to charitable causes and by setting up a sort of chapel in his house for private prayer and worship. But then, around the time when Peter was having his vision, he too had one where an angel appeared to him and told him to go find Peter, because Peter had good news for him fresh off the presses, that for the first time ever anywhere, non-Jewish people could worship the Jewish God without first converting to all the Jewish practices. Cornelius was about to hear from Peter for the first time ever anywhere, because to Jesus, the worship of God had been unhitched from the Jewish culture. And it was now possible to worship God regardless of what culture we were born into. It's kind of like before Peter's vision, only Chinese people were allowed to eat Chinese food. So anyone wanting a chow mein would have to show the Chinese passport first. But now, after Peter's vision, anyone can eat Chinese food without changing their citizenship. And now, the narrator tells us, Peter did not hesitate. Imagine that. An idea so ingrained in him about the danger of standing too close to non-Jewish people, he did not for a second guess his new marching orders, but immediately left the strangers and went into the house of this untouchable person. And now he's in trouble with the Jewish leaders of the church. There were two counts against him. One for going into the house of the non-Jewish person, and second for sharing a meal with non-Jewish people and eating foods that were not allowed in the proper Jewish diet. And the crime was total spiritual contamination, both on the inside and outside. So here was Peter defending his actions. He told them about his vision, that God was doing a new thing in the world, that he did nothing wrong because he was only being obedient to his new marching orders. And the proof of this was really that this is really the new thing God was doing, was how God the Spirit made his presence felt in that house, which was exactly what Peter felt on the day of Pentecost when God's Spirit was given to the Jewish Christians. These non-Jewish people experienced God's Spirit and worship God and evidence the same passion and love and intensity as the Jewish Christians did when the Spirit came. So Peter's closing argument was in verse 17. If God gave them the same gift he gave us who believed in the Lord Jesus Christ, who was I to think I could stand in God's way? And with that, Peter was declared innocent of his charges, and the leaders confirmed that God had made himself accessible to the whole world and will receive worship from every language and ethnicity and culture. There was no longer Jewish and non-Jewish, no longer kosher and non-kosher, just one big multicultural family of God. Now, if we saunter this story a bit deeper, we would realize that we are also extras in the story, because if we don't have Jewish blood in us, when Peter spoke up in defense of Cornelius and every non-Jewish person in that house on that day, Peter was also speaking up and fighting for us and for our inclusion into what had been a Jewish-only religion. Because of Peter's vision and his conviction of what God was telling him with that vision, we can enter into relationship with God without first converting ourselves to the cultural practices of the Jewish people, with all the rituals and rules that go with that. And if we then saunter it further, we would realize that the people we know, the neighbors where we live and work, are also extras in the story. That right at this moment, God may have a Cornelius in the orbit of our lives, whom God is about to send to us to knock on our door, so we would be their Peter and help push open a door for them to become a child of God and come into the Christian family. Because in John 13, when Jesus, in the middle of the Last Supper, to the disciples' horror, grabbed a tub of water and a towel and proceeded to wash their feet like a household slave, and then told them, "A new command I give you, love one another. As I have loved you, you must love one another." Peter had no idea at the time that Jesus wasn't just talking about the people in that room that he was to go and love. And Jesus wasn't just telling them to love his Jewish kinspeople. He had no idea that Jesus was commanding him to love people who had been considered unlovable by his culture and people who were invisible in Roman society. God's love for Cornelius and the command to go love Cornelius came as a surprise to Peter. Luke tells us in Luke 4:18, that Jesus taught he came to proclaim the good news to the poor, freedom for the prisoner, and set the oppressed free. that God's invitation to friendship is not just extended to A-listers, however we may compile our list. But God wants to be friends with everybody, especially those extras who live in the background in the sub-basements of society that we prefer not to see. Extras who are told by the director to not do anything to draw attention to themselves away from the stars of the movie. My nephew Micah turns 19 this summer. I met him in the hospital when he was 1 day old. He put his mom through a grueling delivery, and he emerged with rosy cheeks and a full head of hair. Now, I admit to you that when I first met him in that plastic box, eyes closed and sleeping, I don't know if I thought of him as a person, not right away. I think the first time he felt like a person to me was when he was 18 months old or so, crawling around on my mom's bedroom floor exploring. And he became fascinated with a door hinge. The way he grabbed the door to work the hinge and query and question what he was seeing made me think, wow, there's something going on in that head and body. There's something like a person there. Now, of course, he was always a person before that. He didn't need me to grant him person status. His personhood came from God, who thought him up and made him and birthed him. But that was the moment he became a person to me, because I stopped what I was doing that morning and decided to hang out with him in my mom's room and watch him and paid attention to him. He became a person to me because I made a space for him in me and treated him like a person. But even though his personhood originated from the Creator, like all of us, derived importance and dignity from our Creator, and even though it's not me treating him like a person that makes him a person in God's eyes, in a strange way though, a very human way, we all need other people to see us, to pay attention to us, and treat us with dignity and respect for us to feel our own personhood. Me treating Micah like a person contributed to him feeling like a person. Every newborn baby spends the first couple of days in the world looking for a face and a pair of eyes to latch onto. That's how they begin to know and feel that they are persons, that they matter. And hopefully my nephew feels like he's a person who matters in the world and to God. If he does, it would be because the people around him treat him like he matters, that he's worth time and attention, and they love him with the dignity a human being deserves. Because as someone in this community keeps reminding us, everyone is created in the image of God. Everyone is an image bearer. And maybe it's because of these reminders from him to us that there are so many stories in this community about how we found our way in here and decided to come back and stay, because we were treated like persons here at a time when we were not feeling like persons in our skin. Jesus tells us to love him by loving people, that the good news we carry in the world is good in the way we recognize and celebrate God's image in people and all the dignity and respect that calls for. That Jesus wants us to extend to everyone the same esteem and honor we would extend to him, especially those people whom the world ignores and treat with indifference. This is exactly what the first Christians did with conviction and compassion for the Corneliuses, the poor and imprisoned and the oppressed. They help people realize and feel their dignity and respect as people created in the image of God, and they turned the Roman Empire upside down from the basement up. Have you ever been excluded from something? A club you couldn't get into? Rejected and ignored because you don't fit in? There's a singing group I've been thinking about joining for a while, but among the different reasons I have not actually gone and auditioned, It is because I fear they wouldn't want me. It's not a good feeling to be rejected and excluded. And it's a common experience that most of us know, especially as immigrants and women in leadership or indigenous people, and people who don't make the aid list. And the more important the relationship, like with bosses and parents and God, the deeper the cut of rejection feels. Did Cornelius have any reservations about calling on Peter on that day, when he had never been given the time of day by all the other Peters he knew and tried to talk to before? Did he feel like the kids I met in Bogota, Colombia, pressing the faces in the window of the Burger King, watching the group of us eat our burgers? We felt so convicted at some point that we gathered up our uneaten burgers and went and gave the kids our dinner. When I was growing up in church, I had three friends who were not baptized because the parents disapproved of them being Christian. And because they were not baptized, the church didn't allow them to take communion either. And around the time when I learned that baptism and communion were rituals meant to create an experience of belonging, both us to God and us to each other, it occurred to me that if we were going to continue to exclude them from the communion table while they're working things out with their parents, then we need to do something else to make sure they feel like they're part of the family. That in a way, they needed to feel like a part of the church family even more than the rest of us who get to take communion. Because Jesus never treated anyone like they were just an invisible extra to his important life. Jesus loved everyone with the same dignity and respect as persons made in the image of God. And Peter did not hesitate to go into Cornelius' house to eat with him like family, even before Cornelius was officially part of the family. So love people as he loves us, Jesus tells us. And he isn't just talking about how we feel towards another person. So much as what we do to serve another person. The way he washed his disciples' feet because it was something that needed doing before dinner in that culture. But to figure out what needs doing as an act of love to someone is complicated. That's why Paul always talks about love that is wise and intelligent, like in Philippians 1:9, love that abounds more and more in knowledge and depth of insight. The love that takes after Jesus requires a lot of sondering on our part. Years ago, when I was a heartbroken teenager, a wise elderly lady in church said to me, love has to be in the right amount. What scientists call a Goldilocks condition. Not too much, not too little, but just right kind of action at the right time. It's the first time I hear that there's such a thing as loving too much, doing too much, and saying too much. I think it's because there are different kinds of relationship. Like the way a parent loves a newborn involves doing everything for the baby, from changing diapers to actually pushing food into their mouths. But that is different than how that parent would love that child when they become a teenager, a grown-up. And it's different again than how we love our friends. I imagine our friends would be quite offended if we treated them like babies or presumed to parent them. I think perhaps whether what we do is truly loving has to pass the smell test, or whether that action honors, affirms, and even elevates someone's sense of worth and dignity, even as we're trying to be helpful. I think perhaps because despite our best intentions, our help can become a weapon of destruction. If in the process of helping, we diminish the dignity of another person and reduce them from a person to a helpless baby, or worse, a project or a problem that we think needs fixing, regardless of how they may feel about it. There's some movie where one mother is complaining to her friend about her kids becoming more independent. And the friend says, of course kids need to become independent. If they don't, we're not raising kids, we're raising parasites. So apparently there's an academic paper out there by someone who writes that he thinks the decline of Christianity in the modern world is a result of better social safety net. So people don't need help from Christians as much anymore. Well, that kind of rubs me the wrong way in a couple of ways. First, to suggest the only way for us to be friends with someone who's not a Christian is through some sort of charity dynamics. That someone has to be helplessly in need so we can swoop in to help save them. Even Jesus didn't carry that air of superiority. And my second problem with that paper is to think that the only things people need from us is just sort of handout. Even as people may need physical help, we also have deep spiritual longings like to be loved with dignity and respect. And who doesn't want a friend who loves us like how they love Jesus? I've been reading something that reminds me the good news we carry today that the world needs, it's the same as what Luke says in Luke 4. And that is to honor and affirm and even elevates the dignity of people created in the image of God, especially because we're living in a time of increasing impersonalness. Andy Crouch has a very good book just out called The Life We're Looking For, where he talks about the loss of personhood in our technological world. How, for example, social media that was supposed to help us connect with each other ends up dividing and polarizing us more than ever, and we're just yelling virtually at each other's avatars. Have you heard about that fast food chain that has replaced their cashiers from people with, they replaced the cashiers with people from Central America on a screen? Because the company can pay people there much less for the same work, about $3 an hour apparently. And because apparently the bosses think that the customers don't deserve to be served by a person who's actually in the room when we pay for our salad. That screen somehow manages to rob both us and that person in a foreign country of our dignity by taking out that person-to-person connection of us buying lunch and reduce it to a mere business transaction. It's how Russia can lob missiles at apartment buildings in the Ukraine by pretending the people in the buildings have no worth. And it's why, as the war goes on, the brutalities get more and more gruesome. Because once we mark down the value of human beings, we can do anything. More than ever, loving people the way Jesus loves people is to honor, affirm, and even elevate each other's dignity, regardless of what might need doing. There's a story about Mother Teresa visiting in San Francisco. She told somebody that she heard there was a lot of homelessness there, and she would like to see for herself. So someone drove her to the very rundown part of town, and when she saw a homeless man on the street, she asked him to stop the car. She got out, and the first thing she did was to hold out her hands to the man. He took her hands, and then he said, "I have not been touched for a very long time." This man had been living as an extra in society, someone invisible whom no one sees or pay attention to. And on this day, in some way, Mother Teresa reminded him he was a person, deserving of dignity and respect. And whatever else she did, she started with acknowledging the image of God in this person. And I imagine it must feel a little like resurrection, being brought back to life. I have to admit this is a challenging passage for me, because I think I'm among what they call the exhausted majority. Lately, I've been protecting my soul from the world because it's just been overwhelming for a couple of years. And with all the heavy things going on in the world, I've been escaping from reality into things like jigsaw puzzles, because I need a distraction from all the pain, which I hope is the emotionally healthy thing to do when we need a break. A As long as I know I'm doing it, and as long as I know how to get back to caring after a break and not leave the armor on permanently. This is what Andy Crouch was feeling waiting for a flight in an airport, escaping into a smartphone. So he caught himself and decided to take a walk from one end of the terminal to the other end and just look into the faces of the people without being creepy and saunter their stories and what they may be carrying inside their soul along with their carry-ons. And he writes, by the end of my walk, I was overwhelmed in a way I had not expected. I have passed people in every stage of life and health, of an uncountable number of national and ethnic backgrounds, some traveling together, most seemingly alone. The stories I would never learn behind each of those faces, the years of life that had shaped their posture and gait, the possibility and futility each one had known and would know, all set to the relentless soundtrack of those two words, image bearer, carried an emotional and spiritual weight that I can still feel years later. From time to time, I repeat this exercise on a city street, in a coffee shop, even driving on the highway where faces are just a blur behind a windshield. Image bearer, image bearer, image bearer. It never fails to move me and still me. This was helpful. That the way back from an empathy vacation is simply to slow down, look people in the eye, pay attention to them, and saunter their story. And God's image in them and what we have in common with them as a fellow image bearer, and then see what the Spirit says next. We would not know what we might be called to do next. It may be something that costs something, or it may be a small thing, or maybe nothing, other than to make a connection that honors, affirms, and even elevates our dignity as people made in the image of God. Mother Teresa writes that it's the little things that matter. She says, to the good God, nothing is little, because he's so great and we're so small that is why he stoops down and takes the trouble to mix those little things for us. Because he makes them, they are very great. He cannot make anything small. They are infinite. Yes, my dear children, be faithful in the little practices of love, little sacrifices. They will build you the life of holiness in you, make you Christ-like. There's a nurse who once crashed a nun convention because one of her friends runs a charity and needed to pass a message to Mother Teresa, who was speaking at this convention. So this nurse found the darkest suit she can find in her closet, hid her wedding ring, and went to the convention venue hoping to pass the note to someone so they can pass it on. Except nobody would take the note from her, so she found herself sitting through 2 days of meetings. On the last day, as Mother Teresa left the stage, Mother Teresa made a beeline for the imposter nun and said, I understand you need to see me. And then she was whisked away by a helper to go and wait in Mother Teresa's room. She writes this, when Mother Teresa entered the room, I stood and spoke very quickly. I told her about my friend and the note, which she calmly took and put on her bedside table. Then she sat on the edge of her bed and asked me to sit in the chair. She spoke with me for about an hour. She asked about me. She talked about families and love. She says it's hard to love people close up. It's easier to hand a cup of rice to a hungry stranger than to address someone in your own household who's feeling unloved. Yet we're called to be kind to the people in our everyday lives. Love is practical and doable and always starts with people nearest to you. I was the focus of Mother Teresa's attention for an hour, and my life has never been the same. So on this fifth Sunday of Easter, this story reminds us of what resurrection life feels like for us, the people around us, and every single person on this planet. Life that everyone has the same access to, which God gives with the same generosity. And Jesus asks us to honor, affirm, and even elevate each other's dignity as people created in the image of God. By paying attention to each other's stories and lives, because God wants no one to simply be an extra that nobody notices or cares about. We are all apples in God's eyes. This is Philippians 1, 9 to 11 from the Message. So this is my prayer, that your love will flourish and that you will not only love much, but well. Learn to love appropriately. You need to use your head and test your feelings so that your love is sincere and intelligent, not sentimental gush. Live a lover's life, circumspect and exemplary, a life Jesus will be proud of, bountiful in fruit from the soul, making Jesus Christ attractive to all, getting everyone involved in the glory and praise of God. So take a moment to begin a conversation with God.